Welcome to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Good afternoon, Avi. We have a lot to talk about today. At the top of the show, we'll be talking about abortion. Apparently, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has opened the door, potentially, to make abortion a fundamental right in Pennsylvania. There's a long way to go to get there.
Long way to go.
But we have one of the lawyers that represents the winning side of this case, David Cohen, a law professor at Drexel University. He's our newsmaker today. We'll hear from him. Mm-hmm. And the big part of our show is about a play at the Arden Theater you saw this weekend. It's called Lady Sitting.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed it. And enjoy might be the wrong. It's an intense play, but it's really thought-provoking. And the performance from the actress that we're going to speak to, Trezana Beverly, is phenomenal.
Wow.
So we'll talk with her and the writer of the play, Lorene Carey, who lots of people in Philly, I think, know Lorene Carey's work. She's been doing great stuff for a long time.
And we get to talk about the 50 best restaurants, according to Philadelphia Magazine, and WHYY's own Kehlani Palmisano, who will be here today to tee that up. I realize I haven't been eating well. I have not been to a lot of these restaurants, so
get
I have
to
a lot
it.
To do.
Get
so we'll talk
it.
About that. If you have a favorite restaurant or you have a comment about any part of our show, you can email us or call us. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. Our number is 888-477-9499.
First, Cherry, however, we want to break the format a little bit here and get to some breaking news as part of an evolving story. On Friday night, Philadelphia police shot and killed 28-year-old Alexander Spencer inside a North Philadelphia store after a struggle that left one officer wounded. About an hour ago, amid rising tensions in the community, officials held a press conference releasing video of this encounter. WHYY's Tom McDonald was there, reviewed the video, and now joins us on the line. Tom, welcome back to Studio 2.
Good afternoon.
So, Tom, explain the facts of this incident and what the video shows.
Well, it starts out, police were going to this tavern, as it was called, more of a stop and go for people who understand what we're talking about. They were looking for a suspect in another incident. So they were going through the place, looking at people. And at the time, the suspect was not there, but they hadn't gone all the way through. They got to the back and were asking the one person that was involved to show underneath his jacket. That created a scuffle, and that scuffle ended in an officer being shot, and then the person who drew his gun being shot by the second officer who was in the tavern at the time.
Does the video, Tom, clarify anything? Does it tell us something we didn't already know? I mean, this is just, I know we're getting your first reaction here, but can you give us a sense?
Well, it shows an interesting number of angles. So there was a video released to social media that was long shot, and you really couldn't see what was going on. This is a multiple camera shooting showing that the officers' guns were in their holsters at the time initially, and then it came to the point where you heard a shot and then a reply shot that apparently came from the second officer. At least it looks that way now. At this point, there's going to have to be a lot of investigating, but police and the DA worked together to get this out because they didn't want tensions to rise in the neighborhood.
Yeah, and I understand that another man was at the scene, fled, and there had been discussion about that over the weekend. What is the status of that part?
Well, that is really, really shown in this video. The video that was on social media did not show Alexander Spencer's gun fly across the room and then a third person, Jose Quinones Mendez, walk in, put his foot on the gun, reach down, pick up the gun, and put it in his pocket and leave. The social media video could have been Mendez's video.
Interesting. So what's next now, Tom?
The DA's office, the police are all doing investigations, and we will see those investigations blossom. A lot of science has to be done, and we probably won't have any results on this for several months.
Thank you so much. That's Tom McDonald of WHYY. You know him well. He was giving us the latest from this incident involving police and a 28-year-old in a North Philadelphia store As Tom mentioned, there had been this social media video that had been out there. Now we have video from inside the store, multiple angles. Tom, thanks again for joining us.
All right. So now we're going to jump right into our roundup.
Yep.
And the big story here is about funding.
Well, so next week, a week from today, Governor Josh Shapiro of Pennsylvania is slated to give his budget address.
Mm-hmm.
And the way these things go is that when you approach the budget address, you start hearing details about what a governor, what they might do or might not do. So two big things that have already come out from what we think Governor Josh Shapiro wants to do over the next year in Pennsylvania. One involves public transit, and we've talked about this before.
Yep.
There is a fiscal cliff coming for SEPTA and other regional transit providers because they got a lot of money from the federal government during the pandemic.
And it's going away.
It's going away, and ridership is still down. So Shapiro wants to increase the state's funding for SEPTA and other transit providers by about $282 million this next year. We'll see if he can get that done. Shapiro also, and I think this one's really interesting and going under the radar, Cherry. He talked about kind of totally reformatting higher education in the state of Pennsylvania.
It was quite interesting, yeah.
So basically what he's laying out is that the state schools, which are called the PASHE schools, Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education, they would get combined in a single governmental entity with all 15 of the state's community colleges. The campuses would still all be separate, but there would be one structure, one state-governed structure that would oversee all of them. And this is what you often see, mergers and consolidations and things like that, when systems are really struggling. And that is the case for community colleges and state colleges here in Pennsylvania. Enrollment is way down.
Yeah, and one of the things that I found interesting is that the state funding would be based on this formula that is partially focused on institutional performance. So you have an incentive to do better as an institution. Also, I should note that the plan would not apply to the four state-related institutions like Penn State, Pitt, or Lincoln University, or Temple University.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this is an issue that needs to be discussed because the current state of the funding doesn't seem to be working. And so, you know, Josh Shapiro, our governor, is trying to come up with a solution.
There are so many angles to this. One of them is that state funding for public-funded institutions in Pennsylvania is proportionally lower than it is elsewhere, and that's contributing to some of the problems that they're having. But there's also just a demographic cliff here. We talked about a fiscal cliff earlier. This is a demographic cliff. There just aren't enough high school graduates in a place like Pennsylvania, which is not a big growing state like Arizona or Colorado or Texas or Florida or some Sunbelt state. There just aren't enough people who traditionally would go to college. So you have to reformat what you're doing to maybe appeal to, you know, second career folks or something to get enrollment back up.
And in college, even state college, is expensive.
Yeah.
And so I should mention that the plan also includes tuition reduction for low to middle income students, where you would pay $1,000 per semester instead of $7,000 plus a semester.
Right,
so
they would try to cap the tuition,
So that would get another, you know, group of students who may avoid.
You have to pay for that, right?
You have to plug that
gap somehow. So we'll see how they do it. But it's really, really interesting. And I just think folks should pay attention to this.
Yeah.
That's my plug.
And keeping with the theme of education, Philly School Superintendent Watlington gave his first ever State of the Schools speech today. Lots of pomp and circumstance. I know you and I both caught a bit of it. And it seems to me it's an opportunity for them to talk about what the school district is doing. There was a video hailing all the achievements. There was a musical performance. It was literally like a school assembly. But Watlington said the public deserves to get a clear, honest evaluation of how the system is doing. And he hopes to do this type of evaluation and speech every single January. He talked about a shakeup in algebra and biology instruction, talking about the future as the federal COVID-19 relief funds dry up. But, you know, I mean, I think this is sort of a PR opportunity for the school district. The mayor was there. Folks wanted to make sure that they were saying, hey, the city is focused on education.
Well, we should clarify. I think you kind of mentioned it, but if you're thinking, wait, State of the Schools address? I never heard of that before.
It's never happened before. Yeah, it's the first ever.
They have created their own new soapbox to stand on and talk about the schools, which is probably smart. As you mentioned, the school system, like SEPTA, got a lot of COVID-19 relief funds. when that goes away, there are going to be some serious, serious mm-hmm. conversations about how to fund the school district moving forward.
And there's the Newt state case where there is this pot of money thanks
there,
to...
Yeah, there is.
But
there
no
isn't.
One knows...
But there but, isn't a pot
but
of money.
People
That's
don't
the
know.
Problem.
People don't know what's going to happen there.
Well, yeah,
so.
You said that, so like, theoretically, mm-hmm. right? The you're talking about the lawsuit mm-hmm. that Philadelphia, other school districts were involved in. To drive more money to lower income school districts. Yes, they won that case, but there's been no resolution.
It's still up in the air. But
so there is no pot of money. That's the problem. And they need the money now. And so one thing that you can do when you need money is to say, hey, look at us. We're going to hold a big event and we're going to give a big speech and we're going to be out in front and asking mm-hmm. and make sure people know what our needs are. And I think that's kind of what you have here with the
state
of the
schools.
And
we can expect this every single January. State of the schools. Here
I guess
in
so.
Philadelphia,
okay.
We shall see what happens.
Let's go back to Harrisburg now. Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled Monday that a lower court must review a case challenging a state law that limits Medicaid funding for abortions in Pennsylvania. A coalition of abortion providers brought the case. Abortion rights advocates see this as a big victory that could create the pathway to a guaranteed right to abortion under the Pennsylvania Constitution.
Drexel University law professor David Cohen was one of the lawyers on the team representing the providers and joins us now. David, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's get some basics here, David. This is a ruling that says a Pennsylvania law that limited Medicaid payments for abortion may violate the state's constitution, but they didn't even say that it did violate the state's constitution. So what happens next here?
So the state Supreme Court said that it likely violates the state's Equal Rights Amendment. We have an ERA, not like the U.S. Constitution that doesn't have one. In 1985, the state Supreme Court said the ERA has nothing to do with abortion. We successfully overturned that case yesterday. The court now said the ERA does have something to do with abortion and that abortion restrictions like the one here is a form of sex discrimination. We just now have to go back to the lower courts to prove whether this type of sex discrimination is allowed or not.
Yeah, can you just clarify for folks, the ERA, it doesn't say the word abortion. So why is your argument that it does infer the right to an abortion in Pennsylvania? Like, what is it and why would it be connected to abortion procedures?
So the argument under the ERA is that it's discriminatory, that the restriction on Medicaid funding discriminates between men and women because all men's reproductive health care is covered under Medicaid, but all women's reproductive health care is not because abortion is carved out. And so that argument was rejected in 1985, but accepted yesterday by this Supreme Court. And now not all sex discrimination is not allowed. Some of it can be allowed. So we just have to prove that this is a kind of sex discrimination that's not allowed under the ERA.
And David, the ruling in this case does not clearly make abortion a fundamental right, but you say it opens the door. Explain in layman's terms how this opens that door. And I know there's a difference in how courts look at sex discrimination that could be helpful here.
Yeah, so we had two claims. One, that it's sex discrimination, and the second claim was that this violates a fundamental right to abortion under the Pennsylvania Constitution. On that second claim, we got two justices who agreed that there's a fundamental right. We needed three because there were five justices, a majority is three, and we didn't get that third. We did get a third who said maybe, but it's just not the right time to address that. So that's opening the door. We have a very strong opinion from Justice Donahue saying there's a fundamental right to abortion, and we just need to get a majority to agree to that, and we're very close, but not there yet. So some other day we hope to get there.
And quick follow-up about the justices. I mean, this decision was 3-2, the full court is seven justices. Two were not a part of the court when this appeal went through. How could the new makeup of the court with the seven justices impact a future decision?
It's a really good question. And so if we have a case, this case or another case like it that goes back before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, we don't know if all seven will participate. Justice Brobson recused himself. He was part of the court, but said, I will not participate in this case. We don't know why. So we don't know if he'll participate in future abortion cases or not. Justice McCaffrey was just elected in November, 2 months ago. Presumably, he would be a part of any court hearing future cases. And he certainly campaigned saying there was a right to abortion, so we would hope he would agree with us, but certainly that's left to be decided.
David, can you clarify for me how this issue might be adjudicated in the future? Like, would it be this case that would then make its way back up to the PA Supreme Court and they could make this broader ruling that you're talking about based on the facts in this case? Or would there need to be some other separate challenge that made its way through the courts?
Either one of those is possible. We don't know what the future holds with this case, whether it will be resolved in the trial court and not appealed, or if it will be appealed, but there could be future cases raising similar issues. So that is a, I think both of the options you just mentioned are possibilities. And we also don't know the timeline. Will it happen within the next year or two, or will this be 10 years down the line? We certainly don't know, but the Pennsylvania Supreme Court left the door open with some very encouraging signs.
Yeah. And so I got to ask you, just to be clear, abortion is still legal in Pennsylvania till 23 weeks. And I just want you to talk about this law doesn't change anything for anyone who is currently seeking abortion services.
Right. Abortion in Pennsylvania is still legal up to the start of the 24th week, or up to 24 weeks, and it's heavily restricted. None of that changes. So the Medicaid restriction that we challenged has not changed yet. We hope it'll change when we ultimately win this case, but all of the restrictions in place 2 days ago in Pennsylvania are still in place today, subject to future litigation.
Now, let's get into a hypothetical here, David. If at some point down the line, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court says that there is a fundamental right to abortion enshrined in the Constitution of the state, what then happens? Does that mean the 23-week ban, the 23-week threshold goes away? Like, what practically could follow from such a decision in the future?
So a lot of possibilities. So one, it would mean that Pennsylvania is not at risk of losing the just basic legality of abortion, no matter what the legislative changes might be. So basically, the status quo, at least the status quo, would remain with respect to legality of abortion. It may also mean that some of the restrictions in place, whether it's the fact that minors have to get the permission of their parents, or there's biased counseling that providers have to give ahead of time. There could be other restrictions down the line that might be at risk of being found unconstitutional if there is a right to abortion, but that's all yet to be determined.
Of course, David, the GOP has pushed back. They are calling this ruling an activist ruling, given the makeup of the court. And so they argue that it oversteps lawmakers' authority. You representing the winning side in this case. What do you have to say in response to that argument that, this middle ground, allowing abortion to the beginning of the 24th week, but not allowing state funding to go for that was sort of like a bipartisan compromise. What is your response to that?
The state constitution has an equal rights amendment, and it has to mean something. And it has to mean that the state cannot treat men and women differently with respect to medical benefits and any other benefit, too. The state doesn't have to fund. We never said in our briefing and our argument that the state has to fund. It just, if it's going to fund, it has to be non-discriminatory in how it does. And so the state has elected to fund Medicaid and reproductive health care, but it doesn't do it equally. And so the requirement in the state constitution can't be ignored that there has to be sex equality.
As we wrap up, David, did this decision and specifically the wording in the opinions, did it surprise you?
It certainly surprised me how long it was. It's almost 400 pages long. So that was a big surprise. It also took 15 months, but and that's a surprise too. But we were optimistic, given the makeup of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court and what we believed was the strength of our arguments. We were optimistic. Did we know exactly that we were going to win in this way? No. So we were very happy yesterday and happy going forward. But yeah, so it was, surprising that way.
Interesting. That's David Cohen, professor of law at Drexel University's Klein School of Law, helped argue this potentially landmark reproductive rights case that came down yesterday. David, thanks for joining us on Studio Two.
Thanks for having me today.
And coming up next, playwright and author Loreen Carey and Tony Award-winning actor Trezana Beverley are here to talk about their collaboration on Lady Sitting, now showing at the Arden Theater. Looking forward to this discussion. We'll be right back. Stick with us. This is Studio 2. Welcome back. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. And this weekend, I had the pleasure of seeing a great new play at the Arden Theater called Lady Sitting. This was adapted by local author and playwright Lorene Carey from her 2019 memoir about the year she cared for her 101-year-old grandmother.
Lady Sitting is about aging and caregiving, forgiveness and love. It also looks back on five generations of an African-American family from Reconstruction to President Obama's election. Tony Award-winning actor Trezana Beverly plays Lorene's Nana. Beverly was the first Black woman to win a Tony in the featured actress category back in 1977 for her role in For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide, When the Rainbow is Enough. Trezana and Lorene join us now. Welcome, both of you, to Studio 2.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you have questions for Lorene or Trezana, you can, of course, call or email us. The number is 888-477-9499. The email address is studio2@whyy.org.
So, Lorene, congratulations on your new play.
Thank you.
Very exciting. So I want you to sort of lay out the storyline for us and just tell us exactly what Lady Sitting is.
Lady Sitting is the word we came up with when my grandmother's used to complain about needing to and somebody to babysit her. And so we came up with the word lady sit. It was sort of a code word so that we all understood that, yes, she did need help, but that we needed to give her another level of dignity and respect for the kind of care she needed.
And Lorene, for folks who haven't seen the play, explain kind of the plot, what happens over the course of the play.
The play goes from my grandmother's being let out of hospital and put onto hospice and sent to our house, where doctors told us that they expected her to live 6 weeks, maybe even as long as a few months. She got better. She got off hospice. She lived with us for a little bit more than a year and a half. And it's about that caretaking year and a half, about her getting better and then her decline. It's how the family changed. And it was her indomitable will, to keep living. And, in fact, a fair amount of fear of dying.
Trezana, you play Nana.
Yes, I do.
You play it wonderfully.
Thank you.
What did you want to know about the real life Nana as you created this role? Like, what were your conversations with Lorene like?
Well, I think those moments where she is by herself, where she is alone, the visions that she's having, those inner thoughts, the fears that she has, and the control, the incredible control that this lady had, you know, and even over death.
Yeah.
Because in the play, you know, she goes toe-to-toe with death.
Yeah, she's like bargaining with this angel of death, angel of life character.
Exactly.
Which is also played brilliantly. And though it's an interesting kind of twist, right, because it's a very real play, but then you have just bolts of supernatural kind of coursing through it. How did you kind of reckon with that as an actor?
Well, I have to tell you, I mean, those moments are very abstract. And for an actor, that's a lot of fun. That's a lot of fun because you have great liberty with that, you know. And with our director and the music and the movement, I think that those moments become very, very profound in the play.
And Lorene, I have to ask you, curating your real life into a memoir or a slice of life is one thing, but cutting it down to a stage performance is another thing. How was that process? And what was it like sort of seeing, you know, Trezana playing your Nana and seeing another actor play yourself?
Oh, Cherry, I was a fool. Who told me I could do this? I must say, so I've written two memoirs, mm-hmm. one about going to boarding school as a scholarship kid in the early days of integration and co-education at boarding schools. And right before that book came out, I remember saying to myself, what have you done? You know, it's not like just going out with no clothes on. It's like going out with no skin. Mm. This is, you fool. You're like, you were just writing this by yourself and everything was fine, but other people are going to read this. Well, what the hell were you thinking? What were you thinking? So that was when I was 30. I have not had that feeling again. I didn't have it when I wrote Lady Sitting as a memoir. But when I saw real people doing, when I heard this name that my grandmother and I share being said, I thought, I can't stand it, really. It's very hard. So it took me a lot of drafts. But then it was wonderful because then I realized, great, these are brilliant, creative people. I have written words. I have changed us into characters. They interpret the characters, and they have made this thing into a play. It is no longer just my story. It's the story they're telling based on what I've written. Hmm. It's a construction. So that was a great blessing.
We're speaking with Laureen Carey, whose voice you just heard, author and playwright of Lady Sitting, which is now at the Arden Theater. We're also speaking with Trezana Beverly, who stars in that play as Nana. And I want to read you, Trezana, an email we got from a listener. This is from Jane.
Okay.
Jane says, this is something that hits home for me with my mother, and I'm sure a lot of other people. Was it hard to write and act it out? End of life can be very traumatizing. Was this hard for you, this role?
Well, actually, my mother passed away about 3 years ago.
Sorry.
And, but, you know, it's very interesting that I have not had any moments in creating this character where I have felt emotionally overwhelmed. Not at all. And the beauty of it all is actually that I growing up as a young person, as a child, I've always been around a lot of older people.
Really?
So, you know, capturing their movements, their voice, their temperaments has been very, very easy and so much fun. I cannot tell you.
You do seem to be enjoying yourself.
Oh, I love the role. It's one of the roles that I have truly enjoyed creating.
You're from Baltimore?
I'm originally from Baltimore,
and
Maryland.
You grew up around a lot of old people, you said?
Older people, yeah. I mean, I guess I gravitated to them because, I don't know, they just seem to, I think it was the gravitas, you know, and their humor.
Yeah.
Because it's a generation that, and Laureen has put that in the play. Because it's, you know, you're watching a woman decline, but I said to Zia or Zahara, our director, I said, people are going to have so much fun watching someone die. I mean, it's incredible because it has so much humor in it.
Yeah, it's very funny at times.
And Laureen, I got to ask you this question. My grandmother was one of my favorite people, so I kind of grew up with a lot of older people as well. I want to talk about sort of creating a character, I mean, who actually was in your real life, and sort of when you meet like your grandparents, they are a different person than they were maybe at a younger part of their life, and you get to hear the stories. So talk about portraying a full life, 101 years on a stage where you have to curate and tell these different stories and draw this thread of who a person was throughout that journey.
Oh, well, the fact is one has to give up on that ambition because there's too much. You know, a lot of what I did was just cut, 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 cut. There are all these wonderful stories. And I so wish that I could have put in more of them. But what you have to do is figure out what are the stories that are, first of all, what's most actable, what works best on the stage between and among people. what's necessary, and then, you know, what's your thesis? Any piece, fiction, nonfiction, play, film, anything, has some sort of a thesis. So,
and quick follow up on that. What mm-hmm. would you say is one of your favorite stories telling about your Nana portrayed in the play?
Oh. I love a current one that I was there for, as opposed to an old one. I love Nana voting for Obama. I love the fact that she always called him our young man, and that for her, that connected her to her father, who had been in the Reconstruction, who had been invited to the Taft White House for the reception, who had worked for George Lewis, the last black senator from North Carolina, before Jim Crow shut it down. So the idea that this is a woman who connects Reconstruction to the first black president, I wanted us to understand that that's part of what old age does. You have a whole long life, and if we listen to those people, we get access to other times.
Mm-hmm. That's such an effective scene. It's a scene where Nana is filling out a mail-in ballot to vote for Barack Obama. Before, we were all doing mail-in ballots. It's actually interesting to see it from the perspective of now. And I think I have this line right. At one point, Nana says that this act of voting makes her feel like she's still in the world. But there's another point in the play where she kind of cries out, "Why am I still here?"
Yes.
And that is a line that just shot through me. Trizana, tell me about delivering that line and what you take from that line.
Well, one of the central character plots of Nana is that she wants to die on her own terms. And that line, you know, why am I still here? You know, how is she trying to die? She really wants to die in her sleep, if I follow the script correctly. And because that's how her father died. But death keeps interrupting her. She keeps having these visions. People keep coming in, bothering her. And I think the fact that she is able to vote maybe answers one of the questions.
Yes.
She is able to do that and be with her granddaughter, Laureen. To do this is a seminal moment in her life. So she does ask the question more than once in the play, why am I still here? And then, of course, we have those moments where you see why.
Yeah, the whys are revealed.
Why she is still here, you know, as long as you have purpose.
Yeah. It actually reminded me, Laureen, of a quote from the great Temple basketball coach, John Chaney, that I always remembered. He's told Sports Illustrated at one point, why am I the last one left, talking about the rest of his family? Is it because the worst is waiting for me, or because I'm privileged? Am I left here to be special or to be tortured? I don't understand. What do you think your Nana made of the fact that she lived so much longer in that last year and a half than the doctors expected? Like, was she trying to do you think she was trying to figure out why?
I think for a good part of it, except in moments where her body and mind failed, but when she rallied, she felt that it was victory.
Hmm.
She felt like she had been victorious. Yeah.
Wow. Trizana, you have a career that spans four decades.
Just
and,
about.
Yeah, with a bit of a stop in some places. And now that you are a woman of a certain age, you told our producers that no one makes roles like this for older black women. We are usually the sidekick. What has it been being the star of a show that is centered around a black woman of a certain age?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because, you know, I'm primarily known as a character actress.
Mm-hmm.
And it has really only been over the past 20 years that character actors have been having the advantage of playing leads. And in this play, Nana, you know, she is a character, you know, and I play her as a character. To have that lead, to have that central role is just wonderful. It's wonderful to, you know, have that dance on stage. And, you know, I think of Helen Mirren, Judith Dench, Dame Judith Dench, the British actresses who are, they're all women, you know, 60 and above. Mm-hmm. And they are playing those roles. They are being cast in those roles. And I certainly hope that other producers will, you know, look at actresses, you know, in my age range and want to give us quality roles, roles of substance, and give us leads, because there's, you know, as you know, as you grow older, you develop more substance, and you have lived longer. You've seen more. You've navigated through more in life, and we have so much more to bring to these roles. I just finished playing King Lear.
All right,
as a man, I played him in Arizona Repertory Theater in Arizona.
And I have a sort of similar question for you, Lorene. And by the way, shout out to Jennifer, who sent an email, who said that we enjoyed the show very much, especially having done elder care recently myself. So this story sort of resonates with so many people, Lorene. Is there a lesson that you learned from your Nana and watching her navigate this part of her journey?
Oh, wow. Wow. I should have an answer ready for that, shouldn't I? Wow. Damn. This is a real failing.
Could I broaden it a little bit? I'll broaden it a little bit. Lessons for society, too, right?
Yeah.
Because there's something to be said about how America deals with
our elders,
with medical care in general. I mean, there are definitely some lessons, some societal lessons in here, right?
Oh, Avi, that makes it, you make it worse. Wow.
I tried to help. I'm sorry.
For myself, it does feel like this is the time to start looking at, you know, I'm closer to the end of my life than the beginning of my life. Lear is a perfect example. You get closer to the end of your life. What do you do? Mm. What do you learn from older people? What do you do to make yourself ready so that you're not as appalled by death as a 40-year-old? I mean, that's ridiculous. Yeah. And our whole society, I think there's the spiritual emotional part, which means accepting that we're mortal. And sometimes we think that individualism and capitalism and money and power are going to somehow protect us from death, and we're fools. But also, we can do government policies that make it easier for people without resources to take care of their elderly people without beggaring themselves, to help have better. I mean, the Tribune just put out a piece today on how rentals have gone up so much, and it's hitting the Black and Brown communities hard. If you don't have a place to live, how are you going to get your old person into your place with you? There are lots of ways we could look at what Europe does. We can look a lot at what a lot of Africa is doing to make it easier. We can look a lot at what Asia does to make it easier. Yeah. There are policies. We don't have to make it up. But we still think we're the Marlboro Man.
Well, there's an interesting place to end the conversation. I wish we had more time, but we'll end on the Marlboro Man allusion there from Lorene Carey, author and playwright of Lady Sitting. Thank you for being with us, Lorene.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for our great supporting cast.
Absolutely.
On the stage.
And that is Trezana Beverly, thank who stars you. As Nana in the production Lady Sitting, showing now at the Arden through March 3rd. Thank you so much for your time.
Yes, and coming up, we'll take you on a culinary trip with Philly Mag's Best 50 Restaurants. Stick with us. Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman. Arendt. Cherry, you know I feel passionately about this, that Philadelphia is one of the best food cities in the world.
Yes, I agree with you. You can go out and get your appetizer from Vietnam, your entree from Tibet, and your dessert from France. We are a great food city, okay? And last week, 9 nominees from Philly made it to the James Beard semifinals. Now, there's a longer list, hot off the press, from Philadelphia Magazine this week. Tell the people what it is. Go ahead.
It's called the 50 Best Restaurants List. Come on, you know this. It's every year.
Philly Mag
does this every year. Everyone looks forward to it. And with us to talk about it is Kehlani Palmisano, who is the host of Check Please Philly on WHYY-TV 12. Also Philadelphia Magazine's food editor. Kehlani, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you so much. And thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk about this list. I'm so honored and privileged to have worked on it this year.
It's a legendary list. If you want to shout out a place in your neighborhood, if you want to participate, give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org.
And before we start going over the list, which we will in just a minute, you had a little disclaimer in the article talking about best, what you define as best. Give us the quick rundown on how you sort of looked at this.
Absolutely. The spirit of this year's 50 Best list is that everyone's definition of the best is different, and they're all valid. And I think through my work with Check Please and all of the guests that we have come on the show over the years, I've really learned that the best could mean a lot of different things. So when we looked at these restaurants, there's so many different kinds of cuisines and cultures and all of these things that are represented that it's hard to compare. So when we looked at the best, we were like, okay, what is the best relative to these restaurants? And to me and to my team, it was restaurants and chefs who have a command of their cuisine, who aren't afraid to play within the boundaries or the rules of their craft. And that's how they're moving Philadelphia's dining scene forward.
All right, let's get to the list.
Okay.
Number one, and I think they're a repeat number one from last year.
Well, we did an update in the middle of the year.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So
number one is Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Correct.
Which is Center City.
Yes.
Why does this one rise above the rest? What makes this place so special?
I think it's the way that Chad Williams, he again takes the rules and just bends them, and he is really able to create a tasting menu, in my opinion, that is just perfectly balanced. And it's such a great progression that tells you a full story. And it's like, it's fine dining, but it's also very approachable and chill and fun. And the team takes really good care of you. And I think what put it really over the top for me was I went here last year when I was pregnant.
Okay.
And one of the servers actually knew exactly what temperature my steak needed to be cooked. He was like, oh, yeah, like, don't quote me on this, like 195. I don't know. But he knew it and I didn't. I was like, I'm in good hands.
The attention to detail.
Yeah. Love that. And Kalea, which we had the chef from Kalea on the show.
Oh, yes.
Beard Award winning chef there. What, number two on the list?
I think I've always been really impressed by the fact that she is just unrelenting with her style of cuisine. Like when she first opened up, people were like, oh, this is too spicy. And she was like, no, this is the food. I'm not changing the temperature level. And on top of that, there was always this conversation of like when different cultures, the perception that, oh, this should be like takeout prices or cheaper. And she was like, no, it's just unrelenting, unabashedly herself. And it has really paid off. And I think it's a huge testament to her work that here's this cuisine that a few years ago people did see as like takeout or as pad thai. And now it's on the front page. It's on the cover.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then we've got, I'm just going down the list here, Royal Izakaya, Queen Village. I love it. Her Place Supper Club is number four. Number five, Cantina La Martina. This place has gotten a lot of buzz for a lot of different reasons. Tell folks about Cantina La Martina from a culinary perspective, but also some of the other reasons why people are really gravitating toward the story of this restaurant.
Dionisio Jimenez is the chef, and he's been part of the Philadelphia food landscape for over 20 years. He worked through all these different kitchens, including Vetri, and like his food is... It's so exciting because it's Mexican cuisine, but it's also an expression of all of the experiences that he's had over time. Like there's something on the menu, it's like huitlacoche ravioli.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, it's playing within the boundaries and pushing the limits of the cuisine and of the food. And like there are so many things that are really unexpected, like for brunch, blue corn pancakes. And like, it's different than a lot of Mexican restaurants, though we have a lot of really good Mexican restaurants.
We do.
When you go there, I don't think that there's many places that are doing like pozol soup, like the traditional green pozol soup, or they're doing, like, over the summer he had this specific squash dish, but it wasn't like a spaghetti squash. It was similar to a spaghetti squash, but he sat down and he told me the great lengths that he went to get this like one specific squash that he was familiar with in Mexico, and he found it at like one grocery store and he made a dish with it. So it's, I really appreciate that. And he built barbacoa pits in the backyard, so on weekends you can have barbacoa.
I love that. By the way, that's just the top five. There are 45 others, but you also have sidebars.
Yes.
You list best market, best daytime bites, neighborhood classics, best on-the-go meals. I mean, there was so much. Can you give us some of the highlights? And also promising pop-ups. Can you give us some of the highlights from those sidebars?
Oh, well, this was to honor the fact that over the years, restaurants had to deal with really unprecedented circumstances, and they came up with a lot of really clever solutions to keep their businesses going, to continue to engage the community. And so we wanted to give space to those initiatives. But I think my favorite sidebar of all is the promising pop-ups. And these are the roving chefs that are going to different restaurants, to different venues, and creating these really unique menus that are almost sometimes served one night ever. And it's like their test kitchen. They're testing out new concepts, and those are really fun. And some of those on the list are Rice and Sambal, who it's a Diana from Hardina. She stepped away to focus on this project. There's Old Liz, who you might remember from Couch Cafe. That's Liz Grothy.
And Old she's, Liz.
Oh, yeah. She's quirky. She has such like a, she says it's, she calls it seriously unserious approach to food. It's very playful. She just had a pop-up at High Street over the weekend that was, it was, the theme was Western Sizzlin', which is an Oklahoma chain restaurant. So that kind of gives you an idea. And of course, there's people like Jacob Trin, and if you remember Poi Dog, Kiki Aranita.
Yeah.
She's gone, you know, she had to evolve her business through the pandemic into a sauce.
Because the brick and mortar is no longer.
Right,
yeah.
Right. No longer. And then Chef Ruby on the scene.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so as we wind down here, I gotta be a little selfish and ask if there's a place on this 50 that I can go, have a great meal, not pay too much.
Okay. I think a great meal where you don't pay too much and you're gonna have a classy fun time.
Okay.
Middle Child Clubhouse.
Yes.
And I know it sounds strange to call it classy, but like the food has become so refined over the years. I mean,
this is like a sandwich shop essentially, right? Like its original place, the not the clubhouse, the one over near the Jefferson Hospital complex, that's just like a sandwich board.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's evolved over the years.
Yeah.
They were always so playful, and I don't want to say that they've matured because they still have, you know, a picture of Princess Diana in a
an Eagles jacket. Yeah.
They're clearly having fun with what they do.
And Valentine's Day is coming up. Advice on where to go for first dates or early folks, and then, you know, the more seasoned couples.
I feel like Middle Child Clubhouse for sure for that first
middle
date.
Child, middle
first
child, yeah.
Date.
It's
we're having fun.
Yeah, it's low-key enough, but the food is still really impressive.
Okay.
There you go.
And
middle
I think it shows a lot about your personality if you're into it.
All right, all right. Middle Child Clubhouse. And that
I
one
check
is
that
one's
I wrote
in
it down,
the
so
River
I'm
Wards area.
Check that out.
Oh,
yeah.
That's in Fishtown. Yeah, Fishtown.
Yeah,
Fishtown, yeah.
Cool. All right. So check that one out. Check out the whole list. The 50 best restaurants
lots
in
of cool
the
ones
region
on the list, and a lot of places I have not been. Avi, so I can.
We have work to
we
do.
We have work to do.
That's
yeah.
Kehlani Palmisano, Philadelphia Magazine's food editor and host of WHYY's Check Please Philly. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
By the way,
mm-hmm.
Thursday 7:30 WHYY TV 12. Check out Check Please Philly, and you can find segments and special content on YouTube.
Yay! Love that. And that Avi and friends. That's it for our show today. Download us wherever you get your podcasts. Our producers are Debbie Builder, Paige Murray-Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Al Banks and Diana Martinez engineered today's program from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philly. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll see you tomorrow.